From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 1 year ago this week in the neighborhood surrounding Jones Park in Rochester. An initiative was called Project Tips, and it was unfolding about a year ago this week, designed to show support for the neighborhood, examine community concerns, and to improve police-community relations. And the Center for Public Safety Initiative set out to figure out whether this effort was working. What did people in Rochester think about police? What did black families think? What did they want to change? What were their biggest concerns? This week, we're hearing growing calls for police abolition from civil rights activists here in Rochester and across the country. But polls show most Americans, at least up until now, including most black people, don't express a desire for police abolition. They want dramatic improvements in how police do their jobs. And if there's one person in Rochester who has an understanding of the community pulse on this, I would think it's Dr. Rashad Altimer, who's director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT, and he is back with us this hour. Dr. Altimer, how are you?
I'm good, Evan. How are you?
I don't know how to answer that, to be honest with you, on this afternoon. Like, I'm sort of exhausted, but like, who am I to feel exhausted? I mean, you know, it's like all these weird, you know, emotions, to be honest with you.
I mean, I think the events of the last few weeks on top of the coronavirus are exhausting for everyone, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, for me personally, it's as a black man and a father and, you know, someone who grew up during the crack epidemic, it's I understand people can feel exhausted. That's for sure.
What I want to talk about this hour with you is sort of a range of issues related to how we understand the way police and communities relate to one another. And I guess I'll start with this current moment, whether it's that video from Buffalo last night, obviously George Floyd, which has sparked everything across the country. There's so many other moments of, you know, brutality. Are we at a tipping point? Is this a change moment that you think is going to come out of this, Rashad?
You know, I don't know. It feels a bit different. I think there's a greater emerging consensus in society that we need to do something. But I also want to remind everyone that we've seen this movie before, right? I mean, the whole issue of riots, if you will, or looting in response to police brutality is not a new issue. We've been having this problem since the 60s in America. And we have this kind of cyclical thing where we'll have social disturbances, and we'll have maybe a kind of a, at first there'll be an aggressive response to control the rioting or the looting. And then you'll have a period of introspection where you have a commission. And, you know, we've had numerous commissions over the last 60 to 80 years. And then the commission makes recommendations or some are picked up, and then we move on to the next issue until we have another social disruption. So I'm hopeful that this is a different moment, but I haven't figured out if it is different or part of just this pattern that has been part of modern American history, quite frankly.
Well, let me ask you what you expect out of the media here. And I'll just tell you that I want to hear your perspective, and I want to listen. And here is part of what I think the media is grappling with. You've got Governor Cuomo every day talking about the need for police to aggressively protect against looting, destruction, burning of property, etc., destruction of stores and small businesses. But he says there is a difference between the looting and destruction and the protest movement, which is righteous and true. And the governor says we must make that distinction, but we also must protect against destruction and not tolerate looting, which he calls basic criminality. Now, one of the organizers of the demonstrations and the civil rights movement here in Rochester, one of the four women who organized last Saturday's events and have been organizing events this week, is Ashley Gant. She was asked by WXXI's James Brown about some of Mayor Warren's comments about looting, etc. She said, we're asking the wrong questions. This is not about looting. She said, you know, looting is not the story here. And she said, I don't care if the whole city burns. That's not what you should be talking about. That's not what the narrative should be. Now, she's not endorsing it. She's not endorsing looting. But she says, why are we even talking about that? We should be talking about all of the decades and centuries of pain that have led to this moment, and the media is missing the mark there. Is she right?
Well, I think, first of all, I think this is, we have to acknowledge that this is a complex issue, and there are multiple things that we have to take into consideration. I think we have to figure out a way to deal with the historic and systemic abuses in society while also recognizing people do have property rights. I mean, the reality of the situation is that I do think that there's always this danger that the shift to the whole discussion about looting takes away from the larger systemic challenges that lead to the looting, right? So you know, it's one thing. I think Ashley's point is important in that while we try to protect people's property, we need to recognize it in this moment that there are lessons that we can learn if we think systematically about these things. And by thinking systematically about them, it's not excusing the behavior, but I think it puts us in position in the future to better deal with it. And so I've been grappling with some of those same things. I know some people who are small business owners, and I know how much people pour into their small businesses. But I also know that, again, you know, this cycle has been happening since the 1960s. And so it points to a larger systemic issue. And you can scream on the mountaintop, leave people's property alone, but if you don't deal with the underlying injustices, people's property will eventually get violated. So I think we got to find a balance. I don't think we have the option of doing the either or.
Well, and yet, you know, we're in this country where every time, you're right, every time there is a Walter Scott, a Philando Castile, you know, to say nothing of the many, many other names that we could invoke here, and there are marches and there are demonstrations, and sometimes we see athletes take a knee. We're in this country where a lot of people say, well, you know, but don't protest that way. That's disrespectful. I mean, just this week, Drew Brees of the New Orleans Saints was asked a question about, well, when football comes back in the fall, you're probably going to have people kneeling again during the anthem. You know, you're probably going to see that. What do you think? And he immediately goes to this, I just don't think we should disrespect the flag. I don't think that, you know, that my grandfather fought in war, and we shouldn't disrespect that. And I don't mean to be rude or blunt here, but talk about not understanding. It's not about a piece of cloth. It's about,
I think, one of the...
But how are we still not there where we, I'm not saying people have to support every cause or support every person in a cause, but to still not understand what that nonviolent protest was about and to complain about that, I don't understand it. I don't get.
I think there's a couple of things going on here. I think the first issue is that, you know, America has a hard time coming to terms with her racism. I think that's a reality. So a lot of things that we're seeing in our institutions that are problematic are reflective of a larger issue of America still having a problem of coming to terms with her racism. So when it comes to the peaceful protest, people who don't want to grapple with it, they reframe it, right? And that's what happened, right? When we had the peaceful protest, people simply reframed it instead of dealing with it on the actual terms. And so I think that conversation is an important point, and I think we got to have conversation that leads to real action. So I think you're right about that larger issue. The question I always ask is, okay, well, what kind of protest? If you want people to do peaceful protest, which is protected and enshrined in our Constitution, then what type of protest are okay, right? Because it seems like there's this kind of game being played where when it comes to the peaceful protests and the legitimate calls by the public to see our government respond differently, people, instead of dealing with those things directly, trying to address the concerns of people, they obfuscate the issue by changing the nature of discussion. So instead of saying, why are these individuals protesting? This is about you disrespecting my grandpa who fought in World War I. I think that's part of a larger discourse, a larger problem where we just can't, we have a hard time still dealing with the legacy of racism in America.
Dr. Rashad Altimer is our guest for the hour, the director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT. And listeners, if you want to call the program, It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email us, connections@WXXI.org. So, Irshad, you have, I think, a really good sense for the possible kinds of solutions, or at least the efforts, the range of everything from individual initiatives like Project TIPS to systemic structural reforms. One of the things I'm hearing a lot this week, and I often hear in social media from activists who say, you know, you're not talking enough about police abolition, abolition, abolition. Now, when abolition comes up, I think a couple of things, and I'd like for you to either correct me or weigh in here, but I'll do my best to sort of frame it as fairly as I can for the audience. Number one, abolition doesn't exactly mean no police at all. It can. I mean, there are some activists who are at the breaking point of saying, we'll handle this ourselves, and we've heard some of that in Rochester this week. But that is almost entirely out of step with all demographics of America. I mean, I've never seen any polling that indicates Black Americans in any large numbers want no police.
No.
So that is not really in step with the country. Now, when I say that, people will say, well, that's because they haven't been educated about what this means. And so abolition, if it doesn't mean fully abolishing the police department, it tends to mean reducing funding and reducing the duty that police carry. For example, mental health calls, some other duties that police now perform perhaps could be spread out to others who are not armed members of the state. It could be a dramatic change in hiring, training requirements there. So the notion of abolition is kind of a range of ideas that doesn't only or always mean that. But what I have seen indicates that at least we're at the point now, and maybe the polling will change, that's not what people want. People want massive change and better policing and safer neighborhoods and more reliable policing. But I want you to tell me if that's wrong.
So I think if you look at some of the survey data over the last 20 years about African-Americans and whites and differences in policing, there's two interesting findings that emerge. One is that African Americans are more distrustful of police than whites, and I don't think that's a surprise. But the second thing is that when asked if African Americans want more or less policing, the majority say more policing. So the question becomes, what does that mean? And most of the scholars in policing would argue that what that means is that a different type of policing, a better type of policing. I think people want the challenges in their community solved, but not with a hammer. Right, that hammers down on the whole community. I think it's a good opportunity to think about what are the values before you start talking about actual policies. And I think the abolition discourse touches on this. What are some of the values in our police institutions that we would like to see reflected? So if you think about these protests over the last, at least the last 10 years in America, it's been around fairness. It's been around equity, transparency, accountability for problem officers, and appropriate use of force. I don't think that's an exhaustive list, but that's some of them. And when you think about each of those values, you can start thinking through some policies or changes and reforms that would make a difference. So there's a lot of low hanging fruit in our system. One example. Is that we know across the country, every year, cities settle civil complaints with citizens, right? These civil processes are often distinct from the actual disciplinary process, but sometimes they're connected to it. And that's an individual will come and say, this officer did this to me, and then meet with a city official and they settle that case, right? So cities spend sometimes millions of dollars a year on these complaints. Yet, I cannot find one country, one city in America that actually makes that data public. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting question for our democracy. Right. How can we hold a department accountable if we don't even know the nature of complaints? And this is something you could do without even identifying officers. You could de-identify every case and just say on this year we settled $1 million worth of civil complaints concerning police accusations of misconduct. And the average complaint involved this type of behavior, and the average complaint led to a settlement of this much money, right? So all across the country, this is happening, yet there's a black hole. There's no data, right? There's estimates like Chicago. Some people are saying they do $20 million a year. I mean, we don't know the number, though, right? And so this basic transparency can take us a long way to help deal with the kind of credibility gap and the mistrust that we see in the community.
Talking to Dr. Rashad Altimer, and so I want to return to an important theme that our listeners have maybe heard me mention a few times this week, but I want to keep hitting this theme and trying to understand it, because I think if we don't understand it going forward, I don't know how we move forward successfully here. And that is the way white police officers, as a group, tend to be out of step with the country on race, on views on race. And here's what I mean. Pew 2017 asked police officers, has this country done enough to create equality for black Americans? The general population of white Americans, 57% say yes, this country has done enough, 57%. White police officers, the number is 92%. 35-point difference. Dr. Altimer, why is that?
That's a great question. I mean, I think we can think about different hypotheses. One could be that police departments aren't necessarily doing enough at the organizational level to deal with the maybe trauma or issues that officers are dealing with. And as a response to that, they're developing negative attitudes about minorities. But I'm not sure exactly, without looking into the data more detail, the exact explanation for that. You could also, if you think about particular police departments, you can ask, is there a selection effect where different personality traits are more likely to be drawn to certain police departments? It's difficult for me to say, to look at the response of one survey question and give you a firm answer, but I think those are two that potentially could explain that.
But does that worry you, that gap?
Oh absolutely. I think that I think there's two things going on here. There is police departments across the country dealing with attitudes of officers. And then quite frankly, for me, there's also broad police officers, police departments reflecting the broader societal racism. And I think that if you look at the last 60 years, traditionally, the problems that we saw with police, disproportionately white police departments, I think in many ways were a reflection of broader white racism. Maybe we're starting to see an uncoupling where the broader society is at odds with police about some of these issues. And so the question that emerges is that the case? If that is the case, then how do these different attitudes play out when dealing with black and brown bodies that are disproportionately in contact with police in many of our cities?
Mm-hmm. Let me get some feedback from listeners. We got a lot more to say here. Edie in Canandaigua is first. Go ahead, Edie.
Hi. I just wanted to remark that the issues that are being talked about are not the issues. The issues are in educational attitudes toward parents. Parents have always been disrespected by educational people. And I grew up on the Lyle Corridor in the 1960s. I raised my children. And the battles that I had with politicians and people running the educational system, the whole attitude was parents are stupid. They have no brains. And what I learned with working with parents, I never met a parent who didn't care. What I met were parents who had no idea of their rights and responsibilities toward dealing with the situations. Their rights and responsibilities were ignored and put down by teachers in the educational system. All of my children went to 43 schools on Lyle and Mount Reed Boulevard, and I had to fight throughout the years of the educational system. And then they went to high school at East High School, and I had to fight for recognition, which didn't happen. They were so disrespectful of students and the responsibility students had earned that they cut out all the things that would teach people the rights of being responsible.
Okay, I guess, Edie, let me just jump in and say, Irshad, are you following? I'm maybe not following the full thread here.
Yeah, I'm not clear on the connection between the parents and the policing issues, if you could clarify for me.
Yeah, go ahead, Edie.
The issues that I'm talking about causes disruption, and the politics with policing is caused by the disrespect that it was taught in the schools of people of power, because people of power were misusing their power.
I got it. I got you.
Okay.
All right.
Go ahead, Irshad. What do you think? What do you think?
I think this is an interesting discourse, and we see this sometimes in the social science literature. And I think one of the questions is this, again, just a broader, it's just a policing issue where, you know, the police as an institution are problematic? Are the police just one reflection of many institutions that are playing the role of subjugating society? I think that's what she's saying. I think a lot of people have argued, I think that the reason that this is really traumatic in our Black and brown communities is because it represents, these problems just represent another way that systems have failed people. And you know, Rochester is, I think, a good example of, you know, we have, you know, a lot of nonprofits that release shiny annual reports every year about how the schools are failing or how we have poverty or how we have lead exposure. And I think one of the points that I think is important that Edie makes is that, you know, when we think about the trauma that communities are facing, we should think about how it's probably, if there are problems with a particular institution, it's compounded by other institutional failures in our community. And so when we think about this issue, while we tackle individual institutions, we can't forget that this trauma is compounded by other forces that are occurring right before our eyes.
I want to ask you a little bit, Dr. Altheimer, about some of the reform calls we do see. And I want to hit two points here. First of all, this is from a recent interview with Alex Vitale. He's the coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project. He's the author of The End of Policing. And he is more on the abolition train. But again, what he says is abolition may mean a reimagining of what we assume police should do here. First of all, he was asked, why are you at that point now? Here's what he said in the interview. Quote, 5 years ago, in the wake of the murders of Mike Brown and Eric Garner and Tamir Rice, we were told, don't worry, we're going to fix it. We're going to give the police implicit bias training. We're going to hold some community police encounter sessions. We're going to buy some body cameras. A whole set of what we often refer to as procedural reforms designed to make the police more professional, less biased, more transparent, and that this is going to magically fix the problem. But things did not get better. People are still being killed, and more importantly, the problem of over-policing remains. It's gone on long enough. End quote. Do you tend to think that we're going to see more of that mentality that, and I think this sort of dovetails what I asked you at the outset here, but what he's saying is, you know, Ferguson was 2014, we saw Tamir Rice, we saw all these other cases, and there was always a promise that we get it. And he says, too late. You don't get it. You haven't gotten it.
So first thing I would do is I would push his timeline back. I think this whole approach to kind of tinkering around the edges and having procedural changes has been going on for a long time. But I think there's two contradictory kind of processes going on here. Because on the one hand, as a society, we would like the police to be more procedural. We would like them to be more professional. But we as a society have increasingly called police to solve more and more problems, right? And so I think that if, to the extent that we have that over-policing occurring, that it's reflected by that contradiction. I think the war on drugs, and even now with the opioid epidemic, is a great example, right? So you know, the war on drugs, you know, we didn't decide to spend, you know, $100 million on black and brown communities to invest and give people treatment. We put people in prison. And even now, when we think about, even though we're taking more of a public health approach to the opioid epidemic, we often rely on law enforcement to be the initiators of that. So I think as a broader society, there's an interesting kind of interesting contradiction going on, where on one hand, we increasingly want police to be on the front line of solving many of our social problems. On the other hand, when they fail, or they're inadequately trained or ill-equipped, we have a problem with it. So I think while we think about expecting police to do better at their jobs, we should think about what society has come to expect from policing, and is that realistic or not? I mean, you know, we have police officers in the schools. We have, you know, do we really need police officers in our schools? Like, can we have an alternative? For most people, we can't even imagine an alternative, right? And so I think that the whole notion of over-policing, we should recognize that to the extent that it's a problem now, it's a kind of a reflection of this bipartisan gradual process that happened over multiple years. You think back to the Clinton era, where we had a lot of police interventions to solve social problems. So I think that he raises a great point, and I think that it's going to take more than a procedure to solve this issue. But I also think it's time for society to also think about the different contradictory expectations we have from police departments.
Well, and my follow-up to that maybe reveals the limits of my imagination here, but let me explain. So if we reform what we ask police to do dramatically, and if we, in some cases, disarm police officers, dramatically reduce the weaponry they have, and have a lot of police officers not carry guns with them, for example. I mean, I had a conversation with friends who live here now but are from Ireland. And, you know, they urged me to watch a BBC report in which there was a tense situation in which Irish police were called to a house. And, you know, it ended without much incident. But she said, those officers don't even have guns on them. They don't carry guns. And I said, well, I mean, okay. And she said, why are we sending police with guns everywhere they go? I you know, so our friends in Europe don't really get it. Even in tense situations, police are often unarmed, whereas here they carry guns everywhere. And now we're seeing this call, scale back what police do, scale back the arms that they carry. The limits of my imagination, Dr. Altheimer, are this. We are not Europe. We have more than 300 million, maybe 400 million guns. We are a society drowning in guns. And without a change in the number of firearms that are in circulation in this country, is it realistic to dramatically reform what police are able to do? I don't mean to be cynical or unimaginative, but I am observing the difference, you know, and so help me understand that more.
I think the first thing that we should acknowledge here is that even our own American data show that police use of force amongst police is used in less than 1% of all police contacts, right? So if you think about a society of 300 million people and all the different contacts that happen with police on a given basis, use of force is used in less than 1%. Of that 1%, there's some disagreement in the literature, but most of the research suggests that maybe a third of all the use of force that is used is unjustified or excessive. So, most of the research suggests that the majority that is used is appropriate according to the law. Now, if we want to change the law, that's a different story. Right? So I think the first thing I want to say is we should, even though we see those pictures, we have to acknowledge that the force that we see used in America is still the minority of cases. With that said, we do have a lot of guns in this country. We do have some social problems like poverty, economic inequality that the European countries have dealt better with at dealing with, that are kind of the underlying conditions that lead to higher levels of violent crime. And there's a certain unpredictable nature to policing. So while you could probably argue that there, you could identify, if you looked at the data closely, certain settings where you could almost guarantee that police probably would never use force, you'd have to recognize that the nature of the access to weapons in our country, there is always a chance for some of these incidents to become potentially violent. So I know that's a bit of an academic answer, but I do think that the context to these questions is very important, because oftentimes people's sole source of data is these videos. The other thing that I think we should say, though, is even though police use of force is rare, and excessive force is even more rare, those force events reverberate throughout the whole society. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is, how do you get these very, very rare type of interactions right? Because these are the ones that are going to challenge our democracy and challenge and our society and lead to social disruption.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it wasn't apocryphal. It's been shared a lot. I think it was Chris Rock who said, you know, he's tired of hearing about, you know, just the few bad apples, because he says we don't tolerate bad apple pilots because they'd crash the plane. We need everybody doing the right thing all the time.
I think that's why that's when the transparency piece comes in. And I think that's when the equity, when you talk about the values, right? I think that when you think about policing, when we think in the ideal setting, we would like people in society to view policing as a noble profession. And if people come to believe that this noble profession has a double standard, whereby individuals who are problematic are not held accountable, or individuals, or even worse, departments protect people who are problematic by, you know, getting, you know, by using policies, for instance, in some states, some cities, every 2 or 3 years, they say, oh, we're gonna shred up all the disciplinary records, and you can only go back 2 years. And then, what does that do if there's a guy who's been getting in trouble a lot, and now he has a clean slate? People come to believe that if a cop does something wrong, he's never going to be decertified, and he can just get a job with better pay in the next suburb over, right? And so I think that when you think about transparency and accountability, people need to know that the profession is not only policing the broader society, but policing itself.
Well, how do you do it? How do you do that?
Well, there have been a ton of proposals. So I think I'll give a few. I think the first thing is that there has to be political will, and I think that has to be a recognition that, you know, this is a part of our, we have a collective destiny in America. And I say that because I think, you know, tomorrow this thing might jump off of the page, right? And then we're going to have a new crisis, and we're not going to talk about this again for 2 years until we get another video. So I think that we have to have the political will to stay focused and to think about reforms that can help with accountability, and then and make sure our officials put those reforms in place. And I think those reforms have to be fair to everybody. They got to be fair to officers, but they got to be fair to the broader community. I think, like, for instance, and there's a lot of different things out there that we can talk about. I think I mentioned the records retention. Do we really need a records retention policies that erase disciplinary records every 2 years? Are there aspects of those policies that could be changed so that problematic officers can be weeded out? If we look at the data and we know that the overwhelming majority of officers are not part of the problem, and it's just a small number, if that's the case, then why is there resistance to changes like this? The other thing I think that we got to talk seriously and honestly about federal oversight and the role of the federal government. You know, we have 18,000 police departments. We have a decentralized system in America, and a lot of our police departments do fine. They're honorable. They don't have that many problems. They're progressive. But some of our police departments, I mean, they're problematic. I mean, and what we have is we have very weak federal mechanisms to correct those problematic departments. So if you go from, you know, at the end, if you have a department that's relatively stable and it has a solid culture, that department should be expected to ensure that it polices its problematic officers and finds a way to hold them accountable. But if you have like, for instance, if you think about Oakland Police Department has had multiple scandals, multiple consent decrees, and because of the politics in Washington, now the federal government is looking like they may back away from these consent decrees. And I think if you don't have a federal mechanism in place to hold departments accountable, then we're not going to make any progress. I think I got a whole laundry list, right? I think another thing that we can think about is collection of more data. And of course, I'm a professor, so I love data. And people say, look, we don't have time to collect data. But there's a lot of basic stuff about our criminal justice system that we just don't have data on. And so because, like, for instance, if we ask, were there more high-speed chases in Syracuse or Buffalo last year? We probably don't have data on that. Were there more resisting arrest complaints in Rochester or Buffalo? We don't always have data on that. What is the average amount of settlement for civil complaints between Rochester, Syracuse, and Buffalo? Guess what? We don't have data on that. So what ends up happening is because we haven't collected data on some basic processes, it's really hard to talk about accountability. So if you think about processes that hold officers accountable, processes where there's more that push for more transparency, I do think it's the criminal justice system. There are times when actors in the criminal justice system need privacy. Victims, witnesses need protection under certain circumstances. In certain circumstances, we also need to protect police officers. But we cannot lose sight of the fact, when we think about those protections, at the end of the day, these are public servants doing a public duty with public dollars. And this is maybe one of the most important, if not the most important, jobs in our society. When you talk about dealing with issues of law and justice. And if a society can't get those things right, if people come to believe that they can't get law, if they can't get justice from the agents of justice, they'll take matters in their own hand. So and that's why when we got on the phone, I wanted to make sure I mentioned 1960 and remind everyone that this cycle that we're seeing here, if you go to the Watts riots, if you Google Watts riots, Google Detroit riots, the crazy thing about all those riots is they say it was a time, you know, African Americans were already frustrated from the social conditions, and then there was a rumor a police officer did this and exploded. Same thing with Rochester, right? So we have to think about that cycle and how we undo the cycle and think about how our policies can rebuild trust but also help to undermine those cycles. The last thing I want to say is that we're not going to be able to have any type of positive change if people are staying in their comfort zone. I think that right now it's an unfortunate part – an unfortunate part of, sorry, I have a 5-year-old who's
that's okay. I love it.
he's more interested in downloading a new game on his Amazon Kindle than some highfalutin talk about police accountability. So I apologize about that.
No problem.
But but I think that it's very important that we have to get out of our comfort zones, because if we stay in our comfort zones, we won't be able to push for the policies that we need. Another one that I think, and again, there's a million things I can throw out here, but, you know, there's discussion about the militarization of police and should we continue. It was really interesting if you look at kind of how this thing has gone back and forth, right? So we have Dr. Cedric Alexander, who has roots in Rochester, and he was leading the Commission for 21st Century Policing, and they had a big push against police militarization, and it seems like things were changing, and people were like, yeah, why should we continue to give this? Should we have this procurement program to give officers these types of weapons? Is that what we really want in America? And then President Trump came, and he reversed the policy, and a lot of those same departments that seemed to be on board with a lack of militarization gladly took that stuff, right? And so I think we also need to have a frank discussion with local leaders about accountability, right? Where do we stand on these issues? And at the local level, I think the local officials have the most responsibility around transparency, because even if there is not a state mandate, you can still be transparent. Right. I think you can give some kudos to RPD on this. We can critique RPD a lot, but I think you got to give them kudos in that they have an open data portal, right? And they're increasingly trying to put more information on the open data portal. And I think every jurisdiction in the country should have an open data portal. And things, you shouldn't have to foil a lot of information except the most sensitive data.
I am way late for our only break of the hour. We're going to take it now, and then we're going to get to your feedback for the rest of the hour with Dr. Irshad Altimer, the director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections. Do you want your favorite companies, your favorite brands offering support for protest movements? Do you think that's empty and crass and opportunistic, or do you think that's a valuable contribution to the discourse? We'll talk about the precarious spot businesses are in and what we expect as consumers. Then in our second hour, a conversation about sports, youth sports. Some are coming back. Some are still canceled. How to make sense of it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get to some of your feedback. And boy, there is a lot of it. Let's keep it tight. Emmett in Rochester. Go ahead, Emmett.
Yeah, I just had a question. I have a couple things, but real quick. What happened to bicycle policing in the city? I remember particularly Monroe in the 90s, the Monroe Avenue neighborhood, cops out on bikes, not heavily loaded with equipment, becoming a part of the neighborhood. People talked to them, hung out. But I don't think I've seen that since.
I don't know the answer. Do you, Dr. Altimer?
No, I don't. I know that RPD does have, RPD was one of the few police departments to have a deputy chief of community engagement, and that was one of the recommendations of the Commission for 21st Century Policing. And I think that they have a series of initiatives. I think of course, COVID disrupted a lot, but it was my understanding that they were reorganizing that department and really trying to get out in the community and do more with that. But I don't know about the bike component to that.
Okay. Emmett, okay. Anything else, sir?
Yeah, you also spoke really negatively about police in the schools, which seems to me to be the only real opportunity for kids to get to know these guys as people. Because in the city school district anyway, where I teach, they uniformly hate police.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Emmett. Go ahead, Irshad.
I don't think I was trying to speak negatively about police in schools. I think the research on school resource officers is mixed, and it suggests that the places with school resource officers have more arrests. Now, we put police in schools in the 90s because, quite frankly, some of the violence from our neighborhoods was coming into some of the schools. But at the same time, the question is, are there alternatives outside of law enforcement to deal with our younger people? And I think that there's definitely a role for police to engage our young people. But the question is, my broader issue was, as a society, do we expect police to solve everything, right? So let's put the police in the schools. Why can't we solve those issues in our schools without a police presence? I think that's an important question that a lot of people are asking. I don't think people are asking that question are necessarily negative or anti-police. It's just a larger issue of what's the appropriate use of our societal resources, and in what context should they be marshaled?
Andy writes to say, I haven't heard this mentioned yet, but I think there's a problem with policing being used as a revenue stream. When communities of color are over-targeted by police and then being issued citations, in essence, that funds their own oppression. It makes sense to me that targeted communities are apprehensive with police on this very basic level, and it just builds from there. What do you make of that, Dr. Altimer?
The Justice Department actually found that with Ferguson, that Ferguson was funding their activities with ticketing. And so it ended up being an extra tax on the majority poor population. There's other research, but that research tends to focus on suburban departments. Suburban departments that often, in our segregated metropolitan areas, often border poor black cities, and how these departments target minorities and poor people in an attempt to make more money. So there is some Justice Department evidence to suggest that that has at least happened in some suburban areas. Hmm.
Judy says, what was the gender breakdown of the Pew survey respondents? The white police response was probably predominantly male, but the general white population group may have been 50% female. Women often have a much different take on social issues, so the apparent discrepancy might in part be a gender dependent. That's from Judy. That's a fair point, Judy. And Dr. Altimer, is there any reason to believe that if the police force had more women, that there would be different outcomes?
This is really interesting, because while we know that individuals have different individual attitudes, we also know that institutional roles shape behavior. And so I think this, in the short answer, not necessarily. We found, for instance, some places like Detroit that has a majority black police department still has had civil rights violations. And that's kind of quite surprising. You say, wait a minute, Detroit's the blackest city in America with a black leadership and a black police department. And, well, if it's a black police department but it's still using problematic tactics, it's going to have civil rights violations. And so I think that while the diversity of policing seems to lead to other, there's evidence that in terms of relations with police, and how people view the police, that can matter. In terms of the use of force, I don't think the evidence is clear that just shifting out the officer without looking at a broader discussion about policies and practices and the locations where police efforts are concentrated, those things alone won't solve the problem.
Okay. John and Webster next on the phone. Go ahead, John. Keep it tight.
Right. Thanks, Evan. Going back to the 97% who think so much has been done for the blacks and browns. I don't think the majority of raw recruits go into the service, law enforcement, thinking of racist tendencies or being bigots. I think they're trained by somebody who's been there for a few years who has that kind of thought from somebody who trained him. Hmm. That's what I think happens. And in my own experience, going back to the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, when I started in the 60s, I saw it there. I never became racist, never became a bigot on things like that, but I saw it all the way up the line in the officers, the agents who were working the streets. Hmm. That's where it was.
Right.
Thank you.
John, thank you. So training, he thinks it's passed down some of these views. What do you think, Dr.
I think the culture of departments can play a role. I also think something else going on here where we have a segregated society, and we have people who come into the police force who want to help and make a difference, but they haven't had a lot of interaction necessarily with people of color before they become police officers. And I think that policing is a tough job, and sometimes you see people at your worst, and I think that can help reinforce certain stereotypes if the police department doesn't have policies to deal with those realities of just kind of the tough nature of policing. I mean, I think that racism is obviously reprehensible, but I think that our institutions don't always do a good job of addressing racism. And that's whether it's hospitals, police, schools, there's a great amount of denial across institutions when racism emerges. So I think it's entirely possible that some organizations with a problematic culture can reinforce racist attitudes.
That's a great point, though. You know, if you're a white person, you get into policing, you want to help the community, but you're sort of in a bubble, and we often are, and you don't have a lot of experience with people of color, and your only experience is that police work, you may start drawing conclusions. Whereas if you come across white people who are struggling, well, you're also dealing with white people in your daily life who are not, and you're not drawing overall arching generalizations. Just maybe another product of the bubbles we live in. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's also to the extent that hypothesis is correct. I mean, it also simply reflects the broader social segregation, racial segregation in our society, right? And how that broader racial segregation can contribute to this problem in a way that we don't always understand, right? And so that's why I keep trying to emphasize here, while we talk about the police and while we talk about these institutions, we have to understand that if there are problems with racism, there's a broader context we have to also think about.
Doctor,
I was just getting warmed up, Evan. I was just getting warmed up.
Dr. Altimer, let's just do this all afternoon. Listen, you've got a beautiful family that you're gonna hang with, and I'm going to go pick up my son, and I hope we all can have a beautiful, peaceful weekend. But I also know people feel a lot of pain and a lot of concern. And I want to thank you for the light that you're helping shed. I know you are busy. I hope we can talk again soon.
Thank you, Evan.
That is one of the really wise and important voices in this community, Dr. Irshad Altimer, Director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT. From the whole team here, Rob, Megan, and me, Evan, we do hope you have a peaceful weekend. And we will be back with you next week on Member-Supported Public Radio.